Today is Tuesday, August the 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington. Coming up, President Trump criticized his top coronavirus response task leader after she warned that the pandemic is extraordinarily widespread in the U.S. President Trump is also encouraging Americans to socially distance and wear masks in public.
To that end, I urge all Americans to continue to socially distance, wash your hands, wear a mask when you cannot avoid crowded places, and to protect the elderly. Very, very important, protect the elderly.
Democratic leaders in the U.S. Congress and White House negotiators say that they have made progress in talks on a new coronavirus relief bill. And much of Europe is again sweltering under soaring temperatures and struggling with extreme dryness and forest fires. Stay tuned. These stories and more coming up right here on International Edition. President Trump offered a rare rebuke of the White House coronavirus task leader, Dr. Deborah Birx, after she said that the U.S. was in a different phase of the COVID-19 outbreak. AP Washington correspondent Saga Meghani reports.
Dr. Deborah Birx said yesterday widespread infections in urban and rural America mark a new phase for the pandemic. The president's accusing Birx of making the comment in response to House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who told ABC's This Week she's lost confidence in Birx because the president who appointed her has been spreading disinformation about the virus. The president tweets Birx took the bait, calling her response to Pelosi pathetic. Birx told CNN her comments are driven by data, and she'd stake her 40-year career on using data to implement programs to save lives. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
Dr. Anthony Fauci defended Dr. Birx, saying that what she meant by a new phase was that there is community spread of coronavirus throughout the country right now.
It becomes much more complicated when you have community spread, which is very insidious. That's what she meant by a different phase of where we're going right now, because it isn't easily identifiable who these spreaders are. That makes it much more difficult to contain.
Democratic leaders in the U.S. Congress and White House negotiators say that they have made progress in talks on a new coronavirus relief bill. The talks come days after the expiration of the $600 a week in federal unemployment benefits. They were part of an earlier coronavirus aid effort. Saga Meghani reports.
Trump administration negotiators and top Democrats say they made progress over the weekend, but all sides predict a long slog ahead, with at least several more days of talks needed to reach a deal. They've already agreed on another round of $1,200 direct payments to Americans, but extending the $600 per week in supplemental jobless benefits remains a big issue, with the White House pitching a short-term extension and Democrats insisting on making it part of a much broader package, with nearly $1 trillion in state and local government aid. Sagar Meghani, Washington.
A Manhattan prosecutor who is trying to get President Donald Trump's tax returns told the judge that he was justified in demanding them. Trump's lawyers last month said that the grand jury subpoena of the tax returns were issued in bad faith and amounted to harassment of the president. Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus R. Vance Jr. is seeking 8 years of President Trump's tax returns. Trump says that the move is a continuation of what he calls a witch hunt.
This has been going on for 3.5, 4 years. Even before I got in, this was starting with the Mueller deal. Mueller started a little bit after, but it started with some of the people that you know very well, the names Strzok and Page, and all of the different people call me. This has been going on. This is a continuation of the worst witch hunt in American history. And there's nothing that I know even about it.
President Trump threatened to sue Nevada after Democratic lawmakers passed a bill on Sunday that would send mail-in ballots to every voter ahead of November's presidential elections in the light of the coronavirus pandemic. Meanwhile, Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden says that President Trump is telling, quote, bold-faced lies about voting by mail to distract from his own failures. Biden's remarks are his strongest on the issue since Trump tweeted last week that he would not trust the results of an election that included widespread mail voting, a measure many observers say is critical during the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. President Donald Trump says that the U.S. government should get a substantial portion of the sales price of the U.S. operations of the popular short video app TikTok after China's ByteDance agreed to divest the U.S. operations of TikTok completely. Sierra Lee reports.
As relations between the U.S. and China deteriorate, the short video app TikTok has emerged as a flashpoint in the dispute between the world's two largest economies. Now, the Chinese owner of the app, ByteDance, has agreed to divest the U.S. operations of TikTok completely in a bid to save a deal with the White House. The latest developments are according to two people familiar with the matter. It comes after President Trump said on Friday he had decided to ban the popular video app. U.S. officials have said TikTok, under its Chinese parent, poses a national risk because of the personal data it handles. ByteDance's concession would test whether Trump's threat to ban TikTok is a negotiating tactic or whether he's intent on cracking down on the app. TikTok boasts it has 100 million users in the U.S. ByteDance was previously seeking to keep a minority stake in the U.S. business of TikTok, which the White House has rejected. Under the new proposed deal, sources said ByteDance would exit completely and Microsoft would take over TikTok in the United States. They added that some ByteDance investors that are based in the U.S. may be given the opportunity to take minority stakes in the business. About 70% of ByteDance's outside investors come from the U.S. ByteDance in Beijing and Microsoft did not respond to a request for comment.
Summer heat waves are becoming the new normal across the region. But as governments cope with the coronavirus pandemic, some experts fear that this environmental red flag is not getting the attention it deserves. Lisa Bryant has more from Paris.
Not so long ago, a rainy, cold August in Paris might surprise tourists, but not Parisians. That now seems like ancient history. Temperatures hit nearly 40 degrees Celsius last week, or more than 104 degrees Fahrenheit. And after a brief cooling lull at the start of this one, they're supposed to climb again. It's a similar story across much of France, where about two-thirds of the country's 101 administrative departments face water restrictions after excessive dry weather. Rainfall is at its lowest level in more than 60 years.
Generally going to push away to the north, allowing this area of high pressure to dominate.
Other European countries, including Spain, Italy and Britain, are also seeing sizzling temperatures.
On a doublé le nombre de vagues de chaleur.
Some weather experts link the dry and hot weather directly to climate change. Others are more nuanced.
We see that climate change definitely is a motor making these extreme weather events much more frequent and violent and heavy.
Klaus Rodisch is climate and energy policy coordinator at Brussels-based NGO Climate Action Network Europe.
I think it's very difficult to kind of pitch.
He's been trying to stay cool in Belgium's capital, and he's worried about the implications of a future of higher temperatures. He says sounding the alarm in European capitals coping with the coronavirus pandemic has gotten harder. But extreme weather and health events are interlinked. Both, for example, are putting pressure on healthcare systems. Hot, dry European summers have been a pattern in recent years. 2019 saw another record-breaking heat wave and drought across parts of the region. Animal and plant life are under stress. A new study by Potsdam University and the German Research Center for Geosciences, GFZ, finds recent droughts in Central Europe have seriously depleted groundwater resources that forests depend on, leaving a major deficit despite winter rains.
If we look at the last 2 years, 2018 and 2019, and compare them to the last 20 years where we have data, they were by far the driest years in the whole time. And now we already have also data from 2020 till June, and it seems like the drought is ongoing, and this year is as worse as last year.
That's Eva Borgens, one of the researchers of the study, which looked at five countries, Germany, Poland, Switzerland, Austria, and the Czech Republic. She says forests can cope with 1 year of drought, but not successive ones. And at least in her native Germany, she says, there doesn't seem to be a sense of urgency.
At least in Germany, we don't see that much actions against the drought. So especially this year, we had some rainfall already, and so people tend to be like, oh yeah, it's fine again, but the water is still missing.
Another study by the University of Basel also finds dry weather and heat are inflicting long-term damage on European forests, especially pine and beech trees. Last year, the European Union Environmental Agency said warming weather is already triggering a major decline in biodiversity. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The World Health Organization says that it's never too late for even the worst infected countries to turn the COVID-19 pandemic around if strong leaders encourage their populations to implement proven basic health measures. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
6 months ago, when the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a public health emergency of international concern, there were fewer than 100 cases and no deaths outside China. WHO reports the number of cases globally has surged to more than 17.5 million and deaths have increased to nearly 700,000. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says states have to remain permanently vigilant and not take the virus for granted. In the past week alone, he notes several countries that appear to be past the worst are now contending with fresh spikes in cases.
We have also seen how some countries, regions, or localities that had a high number of cases are now bringing the outbreak under control. It's not easy, of course, when leaders step up and work intensely with their populations, this disease can be brought under control.
And when that happens, Tedros says it is important that governments keep safeguards and monitoring in place. He warns lifting restrictions too quickly can lead to a resurgence. The WHO chief says progress is being made in developing safe therapeutics to treat people infected with coronavirus. He notes several vaccines currently are in phase 3 clinical trials. He agrees that great hope rests in having safe, effective vaccines that can help prevent people from infection.
However, there is no silver bullet at the moment, and there might never be. For now, stopping outbreaks comes down to the basics of public health and disease control. Testing, isolating and treating patients, and tracing and quarantining their contacts. Do it all.
The World Health Organization urges people to wear masks, which it says are a key tool in efforts to stop the virus. It says people who wear masks protect themselves and others from becoming infected. This week, the WHO and partners are launching a so-called mask challenge. Tedros says people are being asked to send photos of themselves wearing a mask in a show of solidarity in the fight against the COVID-19 pandemic. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
VOA's International Edition continues. Authorities in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, have sealed a popular Christian church for preaching that COVID-19 does not exist. The church has been telling its 300 members to ignore medical advice on social distancing, wearing masks, and even washing their hands. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
This music is played on loudspeakers by a group of seven members of the Tabernacles of Freedom's Ministries in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé. The four women and three men move from house to house and street to street, calling themselves end-time evangelists. 32-year-old Prudence Maya, the group leader, is referred to by church members as Sister. She says last month, God revealed to them through their pastor, Ngwa Atangana, that nations are wasting the time and resources being spent on fighting COVID-19.
We are asking everybody to go on their knees and pray and know that there is nothing like a coronavirus. It is God's punishment for wrongdoing. For the several wars people are fighting in the world, a man marries a man and a woman marries a woman. So God is very angry.
Among the 45 homes the group said it visited on Monday is that of 49-year-old farmer Leonie Fotso. Fotso says she believes in the teachings of the small church and will follow its orders not to wear masks.
Ça n'existe pas. Pour nous, ça n'existe pas. Je suis un bail, mais je suis pas en blouse, je suis pas partout.
She says Tabernacles of Freedom's Ministries has just confirmed her thoughts that COVID-19 is a hoax. She says no member of a group of 300 farmers where she belongs has ever attested that she saw a COVID-19 patient and none of them has been sick of the so-called coronavirus. COVID-19 is very real, killing more than 1 million people worldwide since December. There have been more than 17,000 cases in Cameroon alone and about 400 deaths in the Central African state. But that doesn't stop the Tabernacles Church, which has about 300 followers and reaches more people with broadcasts on Yaoundé radio stations. Last week, Governor Nasiri Paul Biya of Cameroon's Central Region said three students refused to take their secondary school certificate exams because they were asked to wear masks. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
And in Egypt, the country is reopening churches for the first time in nearly 4 months after a major decline in the number of recorded coronavirus cases in recent days. The number of new cases is also down in Sudan, while Libya, Tunisia, and Algeria have been witnessing an increase. Edward Yerenian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Worshippers gathered for the first church service in nearly 4 months in Egypt's historic port city of Alexandria. Authorities reopened churches across the country on Monday. Those attending appeared to abide by strict safety rules regarding social distancing and the use of face masks. Mosques are open on weekdays but remain closed for Friday prayers and major holidays. Egypt's health ministry indicated Sunday that there were just 167 new cases during the previous 24 hours and only 31 deaths. Figures for new cases have fallen dramatically in recent days, prompting the government to relax a number of restrictions. Neighboring Sudan has also witnessed a relative drop in the number of cases in recent days, with under 100 new cases per day for most of the past week. Nearby Libya, however, is witnessing a rise in the number of new infections, according to Arab media. Libyan news channel 218 TV reported that the Islamist militia-dominated port city of Misrata has been placed under curfew by authorities after six people died of COVID-19 over the weekend. Arab media reports say that mercenaries from outside Libya have been entering the country through Misrata. COVID-19 is the disease caused by the coronavirus. Paul Sullivan, who is a professor at the National Defense University in Washington, tells VOA that he thinks the recent increase in the number of cases in Libya is likely due in part to the movement of mercenaries into the country. He adds that in periods of conflict, social distancing takes a back seat, particularly if you are a mercenary who's not part of the community. Meanwhile, Algeria, with a population of about 44 million people, has seen a rise in the number of cases to more than 600 a day in recent days, double the number of infections from just a month ago. The European Union suspended travel from Algeria to the EU last week due to the increase. Saeed Sadiq, well-known Egyptian political sociologist who is now in Tunisia, tells VOA that he thinks there has been a rise in the number of coronavirus infections in Tunisia and other parts of North Africa because many people began relaxing their behavior after the number of cases dropped. He adds many family members visit from France and other parts of Europe, bringing the virus back with them. Saudi TV reported that there were no reported cases of COVID-19 among those who participated in this year's annual Hajj or Islamic pilgrimage. Saudi Information Minister Majid al-Qasri noted that the extensive spread of the coronavirus and its clear danger to humanity forced Saudi Arabia to seriously limit the number of people attending this year's pilgrimage. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
And while global attention remains centered on the coronavirus, a U.S. special envoy is sounding the alarm about crises in Africa's Sahel region, especially the political unrest in Mali and the growing number of alleged human rights violations and abuses in the troubled region. VOA's Anita Paul reports from Johannesburg.
Amid the world focus on the coronavirus pandemic, another force is bringing death and destruction to the vast arid region of Africa known as the Sahel. J. Peter Pham is the U.S. top envoy to the region and says recent developments there are of great concern.
In the last quarter, by our count, that's the quarter ended June 30th, there were 270 attacks by extremists in Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger. That number represents an almost 40% increase from a year earlier. So that's significant. That's worrisome as a trend.
UN peacekeepers and U.S. forces have worked for several years on a multi-billion-dollar peacekeeping mission in the region, though the Trump administration has publicly questioned the value of the costly mission and pushed to cut budgets and troop numbers in Africa. Pham says this is fundamentally a governance problem, not a military one.
Let's face it, if we really examine the crisis in the Sahel, at the end of the day, it's a crisis in state legitimacy, in governance, in providing basic goods and services and inclusion to various populations. As a result of this, I'm particularly concerned about recent human rights abuses, which have been reported, especially the ones reported out of Burkina Faso by Human Rights Watch. These abuses have to stop because not only are they morally and ethically wrong, but they're also counterproductive in the fight against extremism by delegitimizing governments, alienating people from them.
It is, military officials acknowledge, a tough battle for them to shoulder. U.S. Air Force Major General Marcus Hicks, the head of U.S. Special Operations Command Africa, told VOA in 2018, "We are not winning in the fight to stamp out violent extremism led by several al-Qaeda-linked groups in the region." Pham noted weak institutions like Mali's challenged government have also sparked public protests that may lead to further instability. So VOA asked Pham, "Are we winning in the Sahel?"
It depends on what time horizon you use and what definition you use for winning. If it's scoring specific successes, I think what our French partners managed to do with U.S. cooperation and support with the elimination of the emir of al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, Malik Drukdel, a month or so ago, that certainly was a success. On the other hand, the expansion of insecurity in places like Burkina Faso, in the middle belt of Mali, certainly cannot be accounted a success. So I think there are specific successes in this long fight, at the same time, ongoing challenges and difficulties. So I think it's a matter of accounting and how one looks at that.
There's no straight answer, he said, because this is not a straightforward military problem with conventional forces on the battlefield. This is, he said, a situation that requires attention, patience, and diplomacy. Anita Paul, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Now, even though it's a little early to know the full impact of COVID-19 on Africa, the pandemic is projected to have a devastating impact on African economies. The World Bank says that due to lockdowns and other restrictions in response to the global health crisis, the continent will experience its first recession in 25 years as communities that had been making progress in their fight against poverty struggle with issues such as weak healthcare systems, food insecurity, and a global economy in decline. Edwin Ikuria is the executive director of the One Campaign in Africa, a global movement working to end extreme poverty and preventable disease by 2030. I reached him in Abuja, Nigeria, and asked him how his government had responded in helping people who had to spend months in lockdown.
You can't really say the response has been adequate because, very few people. For instance, I would say in the social safety net, the register of people who are the poorest that are supposed to be receiving cash transfers or that kind of stimulus, it's like 3 million. So 3 million out of 200 million. In a country where about 100 million are living below the poverty line, and when you put a lockdown, you basically just expand that net to almost 150 million people who are going to be living on less than, below the poverty line because they can't go to work, they're losing their jobs and all of that. But if you're giving payouts or what you call cash transfers to only 2.6 million or almost 3 million people, that is like a drop in a bucket of an ocean.
Right. It's not enough.
Exactly, definitely not enough. And now, you can't blame where it's going to come from. That's the point. The point is that, there's a lot of debt that the country has to service in the midst of the fiscal constraints. If you don't service those debt, it means you're also defaulting. And if you default, it means that you will lose access to further, capital markets, in the future. So all of these are just the impossible situation, what we call impossible choices that the government of Nigeria and almost several African countries have to face. Yes.
Now, before COVID, there had been reports that around the African continent that many countries were registering success in fighting extreme poverty. And this pandemic is obviously a setback. Even though we have not seen the real impact yet, but your organization, whose mission is to fight extreme poverty, how do you approach your mission in this new reality? I mean, things were bad, but they're about to get worse.
Very true. So one of the things we've tried to do is to call attention to some areas that people could easily forget. For instance, we have a slogan, not a slogan, a tagline that says hunger could kill more people than the virus. So the issue of food security. And so when people, again, very associated to health, is that if people are able to fight hunger, if people have access to food, they are likely to survive the disease, right? Because good nutrition means, you have a higher immunity against the disease, right? So one of the areas we've been calling attention to is that we should not fight COVID at the expense of food security. And so we try to call attention to that, and by basically saying you need to open up the economy for at least farmers so that they can go to work and they can produce, especially if Africa imports, a huge percentage of its food supply. That is just this pandemic basically revealed that that sector, the food system, is not resilient enough. And so one of the areas we called attention to is about getting food security. And it means allowing farmers to go on about their businesses, so that at least we don't die of hunger. Mm-hmm. That is on one side. And then also to also basically see that Africa can open specific corridors to allow food in countries where there's food excesses to be able to transport it to areas where they don't have enough food, especially in the landlocked countries and the areas where there is drought and, flooding and those areas where food production is really less. So we called attention to that, and we are really happy that that call was heeded and many countries opened up, at least for the farmers, made farming an essential service so that people can actually go to farm and produce. Mm-hmm. So that is on one area. The other end we've been pushing this is that there needs to be a fiscal response. And the fiscal conditions, right, the fiscal space in most African countries is very limited. So when more people are going to get into poverty, if the government does not have enough money to either stimulate the economy or at least, cushion the effects of those who are losing their jobs. And so we've been calling for debt relief and basically asking the IMF, the World Bank, and the G20 countries to put a debt standstill, at least for the next 2 years, to say at least up to 2021, people can hold off paying debt. What we realized recently from the data that was published by the World Bank is that they have received more in debt payment than they have actually given out as credit, or loans to poor countries.
During this pandemic.
Exactly.
Edwin Ikuria is the executive director of the One Campaign in Africa. I reached him in Abuja, Nigeria.
You've been listening to International Edition. That's it for our show today. But you can find us anytime at voanews.com. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington. Thank you so much for listening. Please take care and be well.